I did for you what I do with all my guests, which is, you know, I took a comprehensive look at your website and listened through all the artists and various other content that you have on there.
Yep. Okay.
So the first time that I heard of Blowtorch Records was because you signed a band that I had recorded called the Undercover Martians.
And that's right, yep.
I wanted to ask you, what was it that drew you to that band? And also, what's something you look for in new acts in general?
I think Undercover Martians had that great combination of simplicity, directness, and melody. I'm a sucker for melody, I have to say. And I love noise in general. You know, I love noisy bands, and I like bands who would be considered, you know, maybe a bit extreme or left field, you know, like, I don't know, Can or Einstein, Denzer Neubarten, or The Fall, for example. But I think all those bands also have an element of melody in them. And yeah, for me, Undercover Martians just had those three things: simplicity, directness, and melody. Kind of reminded me of Buzzcocks, really. I love Buzzcocks.
What were some of the bands that you mentioned, The Fall, but what were some of the other bands that you were into when you were a lad?
The first bands I got into, I mean, I was too young for proper punk, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I was 12 in 1977, so I was aware of, for example, the Sex Pistols. But yeah, I was a bit young for that, so I was kind of into the stuff that came after, more stuff like The Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen, that kind of, well, it wasn't even, I suppose it was post-punk in that it came after punk, but it maybe a little bit more poppy or a bit more gothic, in terms of Echo and the Bunnymen's case, Bauhaus, Pill, those kind of bands. And then I went back, I suppose, and started discovering like Velvet Underground and The Doors. And then a lad at school introduced me to The Fall, yeah. And they have been with me ever since. If I could only pick one band, it would be them, because they kind of provide me with everything that I need. There are people who only listen to The Fall. I know that for a fact. But, you know, I have a much broader palette than that. You know, I love disco as well. I can remember going to the fair, our local fair, where I was brought up in Yorkshire, and they just played like disco classics, and, you know, people call them guilty pleasures now. You know, stuff like Funky Town by Lip Sync. I can distinctly remember that. Sylvester, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. I absolutely love those songs. I think they're absolute classics.
I have a soft spot for disco as well. Just the level of musicianship alone, you know, on those early disco tracks when people could afford to hire session musicians before it went into the sort of high energy stuff of the 80s, which was sort of synth based, which is in itself an amazing genre. But yeah, some of the musicianship on those early disco tracks is second to none, like, you know?
Yeah, the playing on any Earth, Wind and Fire track is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's not about, I mean, I don't mind bands that are a bit loose or lo-fi or whatever. You know, I like that as well. But for a track that's going to do that kind of dance floor thing, it's just the sheer tightness of it, how together they all are, you know? Like, everything is just bang on the beat. To me as well, a lot of music should be about dancing. And, you know, there are specific genres or specific areas that you would want to listen to that, you know, might want to make, you know, might make you sad, or if you're feeling down or whatever. Like, sometimes I think you just have to feel down, you know, it's just the way it is. You have to accept that that's what it's going to be. And anytime I put the Pogues on, it just makes me sad.
Interesting. I've really tried with the Pogues, and maybe it'll click at some point. Like, there were other bands that I had to work to enjoying as well. The Smiths was one, Dylan was another one, and eventually they clicked. So maybe one day the Pogues will click as well.
To me, music originally was for dancing. You know, that's why people started doing it, whether it was, you know, folk music, trad music in Ireland. classical music.
Hmm.
And I think you can, you know, people can lose sight of that at their peril. It's always a good idea to have an idea that somebody might actually get up and move to what you're making.
It's something that I think about as I approach recording a new track.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's something that's been important to me since my time with the Hitchcock Blondes. And it was inspired by an interview that I saw with Franz Ferdinand, where Alex, the lead singer, said that they wanted to make music that girls could dance to.
Yeah.
And as soon as I heard that, I was like, well, that's an ethic that I want to bring, or an ethos that I want to bring to the Hitchcock Blondes. So we were always, you know, very cognizant of the tempo and sort of movement of our music. And that's something that I've carried with me into the Milk Harbor stuff.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I take that. I mean, for me, the ultimate simplicity of rock and roll, and you mentioned to me earlier, or you asked me earlier, you know, that part of that question about Undercover Martians was what do I look for in bands on the label? And mainly, you know, I look for something that makes me feel something directly.
Yeah.
And that maybe want to dance, or just give you that euphoric feeling of a great melody. And it is mainly for me directness and simplicity. Yeah, I like complicated music, but I don't particularly want to release it on Blowtorch Records.
I understand.
Yeah, so you know, I would take somebody who sounds like the Undertones or Buzzcocks over somebody who sounds like King Crimson, for example.
Yeah, but I mean, even so, you've got an act, I can't remember what they're called, who are quite mathy on there. And then you've got, is it Liana Forte?
Yes.
Like, that's pretty far out, you know?
That's a fair point, yeah. So, as ever, I'm not all that consistent.
Yeah. Well, look, it overwhelmingly, there's a definite feel to your stable, and it's consistent with the influences that you cited earlier on. And I didn't mean to be a contrarian there, but I think you were a little bit hard on yourself, and there's space in your brain for things that you're not necessarily fully on board with, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's either something like I said, the stuff that hits me straight away, or something that maybe is way out there. That's why I could never engage with stuff like prog rock, because it's neither direct, but it's not far enough out for me to think, oh my God, that's really weird. You know, that's a whole area of music that I can just happily ignore, along with most country music. So, you know, that's great, because it's less that I have to engage with.
Prog is another genre that I've tried my best with. I remember sitting down very deliberately to listen to an Emerson, Lake and Palmer record, and I just couldn't fucking do it. But recently, I heard a King Crimson track that I really thought was excellent. And it's from one of the later iterations of King Crimson, or maybe it's mid, I don't know. I don't know anything about their career. But in the 80s, they'd had a big gap between albums and then came back with a new lead singer and another guitarist who were sort of more angular than what they'd been doing previously. And I listened to a couple of tracks off that album, and it was really very interesting. Just going back to our discussion on disco for a moment, one of my favorite things about disco, and something that I look for in the music that I listen to, and I think we talked about this on our podcast too, is the total commitment of everybody involved in a disco track to do their absolute best by something that doesn't really have a lot of substance if you really dig down into it. But that total commitment and the confidence that you need to implement that commitment, I think, is something, it's like an unseen element of disco, you know? It's swagger, and it's something I think that's important, but it's a tricky, it's a slippery beast as well. We talked about persona a lot in the last
did, yeah.
You don't want your swagger to turn into its own entity, you know?
Yes, and I think there were disco acts who went the same way as entitled prog rock or classic rock acts in the early 70s, you know, who took far too much cocaine and disappeared up their own arseholes.
Yeah.
You know, I think they were in the minority probably, because they probably didn't make quite as much money as the classic rock acts, because the record labels didn't really know what to do so much with disco. Disco is quite ephemeral, I suppose. It kind of comes and goes.
Mm.
As we know, and also FM radio in the States wouldn't play disco. There was that famous burn-in that somebody held, wasn't there, where he advertised he was going to set fire to a whole heap of disco records somewhere in the States in the 70s. But there was this feeling that rock was where it was at, because it got, you know, and it was serious and beard stroking, and you got played a lot on FM radio and you sold millions of copies of vinyl, and even though probably your deal with the record company was a bit shit, you still got loads of money from it. It wasn't really the case with disco, and I guess part of that was also because it was a black thing as well, and the music industry was very white, probably homophobic, and very male-oriented. So when somebody like Sylvester came along, they were like, what the fuck do we do with this guy?
And another thing that happened with disco is it became incredibly corporate towards the end of its heyday. And I think the guy who started that fuck disco movement, I think he was just sick of it being rammed down his throat on every advertisement and television show. Mm-hmm. And the studio songwriter started writing deliberate disco tracks that just were dog shit compared to things like Earth, Wind and Fire. And I think the whole thing just got saturated. And I think that definitely contributed to the downfall of disco. I think you hit the nail on the head with the race thing too. And I heard an interesting theory years ago as to why Thin Lizzy never made it as big in the US as they should have. And it was because they had a black lead singer, you know?
Mm. And yeah, I mean, you would have thought they were a perfect fit for that kind of FM radio vibe in the States. It could be. It wouldn't surprise me. Particularly in the States, I think it comes down to marketing for record companies, and they like their acts to have a look or to be homogenous. And, you know, it's just like that whole thing when Run DMC partnered up with Aerosmith.
Mm.
I was going to say the two worlds were horrified, but I think the rock world was more horrified than the hip-hop world. That, you know, they could take it. Like, Aerosmith's fans, you know, sent them death threats. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they saw what was essentially the classic look of a rock band, you know, with the guys with the long hair, leather trousers, pulling the moves with the feet upon the monitors.
Mm.
And then there was a black guy who was the lead singer as well, the front man, mm-hmm. the main man in the band, black with a big afro. You know, as far as they were concerned, they probably should have been in a disco group. Yeah, I don't know whether it's true or not, Anthony, but it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. And it goes back to what we were talking in the other podcast. You know, we talked about personas, but we also talked a lot about the dreadful effect that the major labels had on music because of the control they had. But also it was very white, male, straight oriented, wasn't it?
You know, something I was thinking about recently as well was how quickly the tides turned between the end of disco and sort of 70s era rock bands like Thin Lizzy to Prince becoming a global phenomenon in the 80s. And, you know, black, sexually ambiguous, gender ambiguity, and an absolute global phenomenon. But then again, there's no one else, like, he's so singular.
I take your point completely. I mean, I love Prince, and I just think he's an exception, to be honest. I think he's an outlier.
Yeah.
I mean, he not only had the songwriting, the look, the attitude. I mean, he also had the kind of business nous as well. You know, he set up his own Paisley Park Records, kept things under his own control. So, I mean, he probably had distribution deals with the majors, but, I mean, he certainly kept most of it in-house, if you like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was a genius, but a genius who could also, a creative genius who had business sense. Now that is pretty rare.
Yeah. He couldn't act though. Me and Megan.
Yeah, I wouldn't be bothered about his films, I have to say. Yeah.
Myself and Megan, my girlfriend, we watched Purple Rain at some point last year, and it's hilarious, unintentionally so though. Yeah, no. And as much of a genius as Prince was, he definitely didn't have any acting chops.
I've never seen a Prince film, full disclosure.
Yeah. No, Purple Rain is worth it just because it's okay. Very strange. If it was a horror film, it'd probably be a cult classic B-movie, but because it's a musical drama.
Okay, so it should be more called like the mutant purple one from outer space.
Yeah, yeah.
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 I don't think I'll bother, to be honest. But then, like, one of my favorite clips on YouTube is him performing at the halftime of the Super Bowl in the rain. It's just unbelievable, Anthony. Like, it's live, it's pissing rain. So, you know, the guitar is soaking wet through. It's sliding about all over the stage, and he knocks off this, you know, what appears to be a note-perfect rendition. It's not just note-perfect. It's beyond that. It's note-perfect, but
soulful,
inspiring, uplifting, brilliant. Yeah. How could anybody actually do that?
And he probably did it in high heels as well. As somebody who seems to be very careful about how they curate their brand, what would be best practice for musicians to present themselves in the market as it stands?
I think a word I use a lot is authenticity. I think you have to come across as authentic, because there are so many channels available to musicians these days, and whether they avail of them or not, the chances are that some of their stuff will end up on those channels. But if they're not careful, if they're trying to promote one image which isn't them, the rail them at some point will leak out. And people are very clever, I think, at spotting that. Well, not very clever, very quick to spot that these days. For example, if a band puts out a very moody and, say sexually ambiguous video on YouTube, and they're trying to come across as these kind of bohemians, or, you know, living this kind of life of bacchanalia, and then on Instagram, quotes come out of them being very, well, for example, homophobic or very racist or just being square, for want of a better word. You know, immediately it's going to destroy their image, because those two things don't correlate. So, you know, I think authenticity for me is key. I think commitment is key. There are a lot of bands who think they can just chuck a couple of tracks onto Spotify and do the odd video for YouTube, and that's them done. Some of the bands that I work with, you would not believe, well, you would, because you're a musician, Anthony, and you've done this, but other people who are fans maybe wouldn't believe the level of time, money, and effort that they put into it to try and make it, you know, to do the best, you know, to put across the best music, the best live shows, the best merch releases that they can. Yeah, I suppose ultimately they're trying to make it, but they're committed to it. So that's two words, authenticity and commitment. I think fun is another good one. I don't think you want to be too serious about it. You know, you've got that commitment in the background, but when you do a live show, I think it should come across as having a good time and giving your audience value for money. That's slightly, again, you see, is inconsistent with some of the stuff that I like, because, you know, I love bands like My Bloody Valentine. Now, I'm not saying they didn't put on a good show, but they would never have engaged with the audience much. You know, there wasn't a lot of chit-chat going on between Kevin and the audience. But having said that, they did put on a good show. I mean, a good example would be a band I mentioned earlier, Echo and the Bunnymen. I went to see them. I've seen them lots of times. One particular gig stands out for me in Leeds, and Ian McCulloch was just feeling very arsey. Somebody in Leeds said something about Yorkshire and them being from Liverpool, and he took umbrage, and they cut the set short by about, I'd say, four or five songs, and couldn't wait to get off the stage. And you just think, that is shit. You know, I paid 20 quid or whatever it was, 25 quid to see that gig. And, you know, check your ego, Ian McCulloch. You know, we deserve a good show. Takes me back to that point about, you know, fun and giving a good show. So what three words have I used there? Commitment, authenticity, and fun. Yeah, I think that's a good start for me, Anthony.
I saw Echo and the Bunnymen in Pittsburgh a few years ago. It's a big venue. I can't remember what it's called, but for some ungodly reason, they serve food as well. You know, there's tables up in the balcony.
Join the show.
Yeah. It might be an old church or an old ballroom. So there's like the floor space, and then there's a balcony space, and they have tables up there, and you can order food, right? But the ventilation system for the kitchen is so bad that you can smell the fucking food cooking during the show. And McCulloch was not happy about that. And it was very entertaining to hear him bitching and moaning about that.
That's understandable. I mean, that's fair enough. And if you make it part of your show, I think that's understandable. I mean, I remember seeing a guy called Richard Hawley. Do you know him, Anthony?
Yeah.
In Sheffield. Yeah, brilliant. Absolutely amazing. Went to see him in Leeds. I can't remember which venue it was now, but there's a bar, well, like a lot of venues, I suppose, there's a bar down one side of it, and a lot of people were just stood at the bar chatting. And he just stopped at one point and said, you know, I'm from a working class background, he said, and we don't waste money from where I come from. And he said, if you cunts at the bar want to spend the rest of the show just talking and not listening, then fuck off somewhere else.
Nice.
And everybody was like, "Whey!" And again, he just made it part of the show. You're like, he's a showman, really. You know, he comes from that kind of background. That, mm-hmm. You know, he started off in working men's clubs in Sheffield. So, you know, he's got the chops to deal with an audience. But it was funny, and it kind of fitted in, because people were getting a bit, it was very loud, was the chatting, and people were getting a bit pissed off with it.
Yeah.
I love shows like that, where there's a bit of rapport and a bit of banter, and it fits in with the music, yeah. Because at least, you know, you feel like you're getting your money's worth as well. Any audience wants to get their money's worth.
And you're absolutely right. Like, people can spot bullshit. I have two examples, both in the synth pop world. The first one was MGMT. I saw them at a festival in Hungary years ago. And they had absolutely no stage presence or interest in engaging with the audience at all. I think they felt that they'd been stiffed on their place on the bill, because it was fairly early in the day. And people just fucking ignored them, and rightly so, you know. And the other was a gig I was at in Dublin, and they were another synth pop band who were trying very, very hard to be serious. And they had three synthesizers lined up at the front of the stage, and halfway through the gig, one of the guy's keyboards just tilted forward and fell into the audience. And I was like, that's the best thing that's going to happen during this show by a long time. And their music was good, but it was so disingenuous, you know. Like, you've either got stage presence or you don't, and that's going to be based on your own personality and confidence, you know. And you can't make that up, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally agree. I mean, that's what did for Nick Drake in the end, wasn't it? You know, he just was so shy that even though he had these great songs, he just didn't come across because he couldn't project, I suppose, yeah? And I guess as a frontman yourself, Anthony, I guess you'd understand the importance of connecting with an audience.
Mm. And sometimes it's impossible. I've played shows where the audience have been incredibly attentive and receptive, and it's felt like a collaboration almost. And then I've had shows where nobody was listening, and I've never been able to figure out what the key was there.
You know, I love the Arctic Monkeys. I've seen them a few times. You know, the earlier gigs were definitely better.
Mm.
They just got a bit more remote. I suppose that's partly to do with the venue as well. You know, the crowds are bigger. I suppose you can lose that connection. Well, I saw Bjork at Electric Picnic, and, you know, I love Bjork, but it was all just a really carefully crafted stage show.
Mm.
Again, there was no connection with the audience. And I think it might even have been the same EP Damon Albarn was on. And he bounced onto the stage and he went, "Oh, I've just done one of those fucking DNA tests." And he goes, "Turns out I'm 11% Irish." Talk about having the crowd in your palm of your hand from the start. Everybody was just like, "Whey!" And off he went. And that set the tone for the whole show. And it was amazing. There's a place for both those, I guess. For me, I just prefer the Damon Albarn model to the Björk model.
And we talked about him in the last podcast, but one thing I've always admired about Nick Cave is his willingness to try new things with songs live. And he never sounds like... The songs never sound like they do on the records when he's live. Mm. And there's always a freshness to them. And that applies across performances. Like, I've seen him a few times, and I've seen him perform the same songs in vastly different ways, and I think that's really fucking important as well.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen Richard Hawley do that, just to go back to somebody I mentioned previously. In fact, I think he might have been in Galway, and they actually started off a song in the same tempo as it was on the record. And after 30 seconds or so, he said, I tell you what, this isn't working for me. And he just turned around to the band. He said, right, we're going to do it half speed and I'll take the solo in the middle. And then they just played it at half speed. And he had this amazing long guitar solo in the middle. And it was just fantastic because it was essentially a song that you knew, but in a completely different arrangement, apparently live in front of your eyes. I mean, what's not to like?
There's an act on your website called Ferosa that I suspect you might have some involvement in. When did you start playing music?
I started playing the guitar when I was about, 14, something like that, probably.
And when did you start playing in bands?
Not till much later. Well, we had a band at school, sort of 16, 17, but we could never find a drummer or a reliable drummer. So, yeah, it was a disaster, really. So that never went anywhere. And then probably wasn't until, my late 30s that I just wanted to have a go at it, Anthony, really, just see what it was like. You know, I was in a couple of cover bands, was in three or four covers bands, actually. Mm. But yeah, it was just vastly enjoyable. You know, I am a bit of a show-off at heart, really. I like being on stage. I mean, I was never a singer or anything. I mean, if you've listened to Ferozzi, you'd know that my voice is not the best, but
I like I know that you like The Fall from our previous discussion, but I know it from the way you sing as well.
Okay. I guess that's just one of those things where it's really weird listening to your own voice and a sense of endless disappointment to me that I was never had a great voice. Like my dad had a brilliant voice. I just don't understand why I don't. It's really annoying.
Again, going back to total commitment, like there's no sense of hesitancy on the recordings.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say so. I have to say that does mean something coming from you, Anthony. Thank you. Yeah, I would have played in the covers bands for, 8 years maybe. I got sick of it because it was one of those things where I was more committed. I was always the most committed one. So I was the one that lugged the PA, or even bought the PA at one point. I was the one that set all the kit up, did the mix, packed it all up afterwards, organized the rehearsals, got the gigs. And after a while, I just got sick of it. And then when I was thinking about doing Blowtorch Records, of course, I didn't have anybody to be on Blowtorch Records right at the beginning. So I thought, I'll tell you what, I'll write some of my own songs. Because I'd always wanted to write a song, which I had never done it. Mm. So I very deliberately sat down and studied how I was going to do it. So, it was this chord and this chord, and then I need a minor chord here, and then I'll have a bridge here. And the first song I ever wrote was Chelsea Mansion. It's kind of based on Cinnamon Girl by Neil Young. Mm. It's got that same kind of do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's not very original and probably quite derivative, but I was delighted when I'd done it. And then I made the name Ferosa from Surfer Rosa, the Pixies album. Mm. Just took the fur and the oza, made Ferosa, so it's a nod to the Pixies. And that actually was, the first song that was ever on Blowtorch. Obviously, since then, I've added lots more, thank goodness. I'll probably just drop that off the bottom at some point because I suppose it doesn't really fit with what I ask of bands. It's a bit sort of selfish of me in a way because, what I want the bands on Blowtorch is for them to commit to being the best they can, to releasing new music, having new stuff come in, to doing the videos or the promo if they need to, if people ask them to do interviews or blogs or do little voice snippets for a show, for example. I think it's really important that they do that. I don't think any band really at the level that I'm working at is in a position to say we're too important to do that or we're too big to do that. Mm. You have to be realistic of where you are in the roadmap, I suppose, of a musical development, which goes from some of the bands that are on Blowtorch have only released a couple of singles, but they're so great that I really love them and wanted to have them. And some of them, for example, there's a band called Paper Tigers from Belfast. I was talking to Michael only yesterday, and the level of commitment that he puts into that band is frankly astonishing. for somebody for whom it isn't a full-time career.
It's something that I've come up against over the years as well. A lack of coherent goals across members of an act can be incredibly frustrating.
Yes, I think that's probably one of the biggest reasons why bands split up, isn't it, Anthony?
There's been so many times in my life where I've been sitting in a room with somebody and explaining to them how valuable doing something to the best of your ability, regardless of the outcome, is. And people just don't seem to get that, you know? And it's key. I mean, if you're doing something at all, well, number one, you should be doing it because you love it. And if that's the reason why you're doing it, you should be doing it to the best of your ability. And if you're not doing it because you love it, what the fuck are you doing it for, you know?
Yeah. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about when we were talking about authenticity. You know, I think bands who are only in it for the money generally get found out at some point. I mean, I don't know that any band these days could just be in it for the money because, you know, the model of music now is such that most people don't make a lot of money. But, you know, back in the day, there were, for sure. And that filters down even to those crappy covers bands that I was in.
Yeah.
We weren't all in it to the same level. And then you just think, oh, fuck this. What's the point?
Was it you that I was talking to about the importance of listening to yourself and being able to hear yourself? Was that us?
Yes. Yeah, it's one of my things, Anthony. I just think it's so important in life, not just in music. Is active listening.
Yeah.
I say that to my kids because people hear stuff but it doesn't go in. It's disrespectful. You know, if you're asking me something and I'm giving you an answer, it's not because I have such a big ego. You could at least give me the respect of listening to what I'm saying. And then people say stuff back to you and it plainly has taken no account of what a person has said. You think, well, you didn't listen to any of that. So what's the point of this conversation?
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of music, I think it's really important. You have to listen back to what you have recorded if you're going to record something or what you've written or what you play. I think I mentioned this in the previous podcast. It astonishes me what people send me. And you think, well, you can't have listened to that before you press send.
Mm.
Really, you can't. Because for a start off, it's out of tune. And, you know, I don't have the best pitch perception in the world, but even I can tell when something's out of tune.
Mm. What was it that prompted you to set up the label in the first place?
I saw an opportunity, I suppose, to do what I have always dreamt of doing, which was to be in some way involved with music. So, I suppose the digital model opened up that door for me. And, you know, I've not only been obsessed with the music. I've always been fascinated with the whole paraphernalia around music. You know, I love the product itself. I love cassettes. I love vinyl. I love record players. Anything. So, you know, I love posters. I love pamphlets, booklets. You know, anything. You know, as I say, I mean, paraphernalia is a good word. You know, just the stuff that's associated with music. Mm-hmm. And there's an exhibition on at the Science and Industry Museum in Manchester at the moment called Use Hearing Protection. It's about factory records. So they've collected all this stuff associated with factory records. So there's letters, there's diaries, there's posters, videos. They've got Ian Curtis's Fox guitar. And it's all just in this fairly small space in the Science Museum. And I went round last week. I mean, you know, just like a pig in shit, Anthony. You know, I mean, this was just like meat and drink to me. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. This is amazing. So yeah, all that stuff I like. I like design. I like branding. I like marketing. So for me, the label was just a chance to bring all of those things together. So the look of the label was really important to me.
Mm.
So Blowtorch Records was the name. And then the look of a blowtorch, you know, I'm kind of miming it to you now, not much good for the listeners, but, you know, on a blowtorch, obviously you've got the big spout that comes out the front where the flame comes out. And it just reminded me of Soviet-era propaganda posters where the workers are in the fields or the commune, you know, holding their shovels and their picks aloft.
Yeah.
When I asked Magda to design the logo, that's what I wanted. I wanted that kind of Soviet-era propaganda look to it. So then I had the name, then I had the logo. I wanted the website to look really clean, crisp, contemporary, you know, no clutter, really simple typeface. So I suppose that tied in with my love of Factory Records. I love Peter Saville and his design. I think it's absolutely amazing. Yeah, just tying in the whole, trying to tie the whole thing together. You know, for Factory Records, it was all about the, you know, they was based on Anthony Wilson's kind of love of the Situationists, which was a movement back in the 50s. And I just had, yeah, this kind of image of, not overtly political, but just a kind of ethical, do the right thing kind of label that had something behind it. You know, there was some thought put behind it. You know, it was more of a collective, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Like any of the bands that are on Blowtorch could do what they do on their own, I think, really. The point is that we've got to this kind of critical mass now where enough bands on the label have had plays on national radio. So, you know, say they've been played on Six Music or Radio 1 in the UK, or I don't know, say, for example, Dan Hegarty on RTE in Ireland. And they've been reviewed on blogs. They've been reviewed, like, you know, in Hot Press or The Last Mixtape, that kind of thing. So as a, you know, the label, I suppose, has a certain sort of power, if you like, in terms of the media. And when so bands who are on the label are buying into that collective power. Now, to me, it's incumbent on each band then to add to that collective power. You know, they should all be adding something into that. It's a kind of unashamedly left-wing view.
There's a lot of parallels between Blowtorch and how I approached the Milk Harbor project as well. I'm also interested in all facets of the music industry, from songwriting through design. And one of my favorite things to do is collaborate. And, you know, a lot of the artwork that I've used on the singles for Milk Harbor stuff is by artists who I know or admire. And, you know, I've had a lot of guest musicians on the songs too, and that's been incredible. So no, I totally feel you in that regard. I listened to an interview with Rob Reed this morning on Lex Friedman's podcast, which is a great podcast if you haven't heard it.
I haven't, no.
Rob Reed is a very interesting dude who's had a very interesting and varied career. He was one of the first people to get in on the music streaming service idea back in the day with a service called Rhapsody. He was talking about the complete lack of insight of the labels at the time. He said he would go into rooms with a PowerPoint presentation that very clearly outlined that the $9.99 per month that he was charging for Rhapsody was on average more than the most avid music lover spent on CDs per year. The labels were potentially going to make more money from streaming than they were from CD sales if they bought into his model. And they just couldn't wrap their heads around it. And then the arse fell out of the whole thing. And that's why nobody's able to make money as a musician anymore.
Yeah, I'd like to listen to that. I mean, I do find that era fascinating, that kind of just end of CD, beginning of Napster kind of era. Looking back now, it seems like it changed overnight. And of course, it didn't.
One point that he made was that in regard to how industries changed previously, it actually was very quick. And a good example he gave was how air freight took over from ships, but how that took many, many decades, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but he said, like, the old model of CDs or physical artifacts was superseded by digital content in a matter of 2 years.
Right, okay.
And it was directly because, or he attributes it to the fact that the labels were so unwilling to consider it at all that music lovers were just like, fuck you then. We're just going to take it, you know?
Yeah, and that's understandable. I mean, I think there was, yeah, because, you know, a lot of people felt they'd been missold CDs. And I know technically CDs are a superior format to vinyl, but you can't take human emotion out of it. people just loved vinyl, and they were forced essentially to buy CDs of vinyl they already have, because people stopped making record players unless it was very high-end or hi-fi. You know, they couldn't get their amplifiers fixed if they went wrong. So people kind of bought CD players, and there was, of course, CD players in cars. So, yeah, I mean, people were pissed off because they'd have to buy music again. Also, they were pretty expensive for what you got, and they were shoved down people's throats. And, you know, there's only so much that people will take. And if you give them a free alternative, or a very cheap alternative, which is streaming, then, yeah, it's no wonder, really. I totally agree with you. People said, fuck this, I'm going that way.
The lovely thing about vinyl is that you're getting something extra. You're getting the album, but you're also getting a big, beautiful piece of art that you can hold in your hands or hang on your wall or put on your mantelpiece. I know that you think that that is the way things are going to be moving forward, and I want to talk to you about that in a second. It's one of the reasons that I approach Milk Harbor the way that I do, because I want to give people, even though I'm not offering anything physical to people, they get the song, but they also get a podcast about the song, and then they get some cool artwork that they can look at online if they want to. I'm offering them more than simply Spotify streaming. And it's definitely
100% agree with you, Anthony. Yeah, it's, you know, I think that kind of value add is amazing. To me, the vinyl LP is it's value add in itself, just because you are getting something much bigger than the CD cover, but also you can do stuff with it. I mean, going back to Peter Saville, I mean, you look at those designs that he did for New Order. I mean, New Order lost money on every single copy of the 12-inch of Blue Monday because it was so expensive to die cut the cover for it. But then also, they released an album by a band called the Drutty Column, which was Vinnie Riley was the guitarist in that, and the cover was a sheet of sandpaper, literally from a local sandpaper manufacturer in Manchester. Now you'd never get that on a CD.
No. It'd be funny to try, though.
Yeah, but yeah. And,
see what that does to your CD player when you put it in.
Yeah. Those things just is what makes me love music. It's just that collision of politics, art, marketing, branding, music, great stories, personalities. Like, for me, there is no other genre, whether it's film, theatre, dance, that does it like that.
For listeners, if you want to learn more about Factory Records, there's a great film called 24 Hour Party People that
there is indeed,
is hilarious and insightful and has some banging music in it too.
Yep, highly recommended. And there's also lots of books as well. And it's a study in how to run a record company and how not to run a record company at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, which just about sums them up, you know. I mean, it sums up that kind of Jekyll and Hyde character.
There was one last thing that I wanted to ask you. There's a blog post on your website by one of the guys from Turnstiles talking about Paul McLuhan's departure from Today FM.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he makes a point in it that I agree with so much. It felt very validating to read somebody else make the same point. Just in terms of how important it is to push the form and how he feels that the guitar-based music industry in Ireland has become complacent and derivative. If you could imagine or describe a sound or an approach that you hadn't heard yet from a guitar-based band, what do you feel that might be?
I'll let that stew in my brain for a minute. I'm just going to go back to a point back in the 80s, Anthony, because I remember thinking, I genuinely thought this, I thought, wouldn't it be great? Because synths were coming in at that point. So, you know, everybody had been, we'd had punk, we'd had post-punk, there were lots of guitar bands around. And I genuinely thought, wouldn't it be great if there was a band that kind of combined synths type or that kind of beat type music with guitar? And then Mick Jones from The Clash started Big Audio Dynamite.
Mm.
And that he actually nailed the sound that I had in my head. Like, I could never have done it. I wasn't technically gifted enough. But he had that kind of sound where he had Don Letts on keyboard, you know, sequencing things, synth-type sounds, and then him doing the guitar. Great melodies, great band. I love Big Audio Dynamite. So that was then. Now, I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if there's a new sound. Like, for example, just sort of going back to the 90s, like Rage Against the Machine had a very guitar, heavy guitar sound, but it was kind of influenced by hip-hop with the rhythms. Like
Tom and the Morelli, delivery, yeah.
Tom Morelli's a genius, I think.
Yeah.
Tom Morelli? Morello.
Morello.
Morello, yeah, yeah. Like, and just the stuff that he used, like the kill switch to get those rhythms on his guitar where it would just cut off. And then that kind of screeching sound that he could do as well. Like, to me, that spoke directly to me. That was just like a fucking drug going into your brain. So I'm giving you examples of stuff that have already been done. There must be something out there. Yes, there must be a new sound or a way of combining genres. You'd want to be careful what genres you were combining. Like, what was that song that was out a couple of years ago? Lil Nas, who did kind of hip-hop and country.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he's still around.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus, it was a massive smash.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wouldn't be one of my favorite genre combinations. I really liked that article because, well, A, it was well written, and B, it really nailed something that I kind of had in my head. It's one of those things where you have something in your head kicking around, and then you read something and you think, my God, that's actually just nailed exactly what it was that I was thinking. I suppose a bit like Big Audio Dynamite nailed that sound. And I think there is a sense of entitlement among some guitar bands, not just in Ireland, in the UK as well, that they will just get played on Dan Hegarty or Paul McLoone or Six Music. And I know for a fact, I have a friend who runs a music plugin agency. And, you know, I know for a fact that Six Music, for example, are moving away. They're trying to move to a more modern sound, whatever that is. But, you know, I suppose get away from that, just being seen as champions of shouty indie guitar fans. I think what Jake said was bang on the money. You can't just put out a guitar track and expect Paul McLoone to play it. And I don't know what the listener figures were for Paul McLoone's show, but I suspect they weren't that high.
I think that's the reality of across the board with radio in general now. I like John Kelly's show on RT Lyric FM, The Mystery Train. He's got great taste in music. But he's so... Have you heard the term chuggy yet?
Chuggy?
Chuggy.
No, I haven't, no.
Chuggy is a new term. It's a Zoomer term for the things that haven't aged well from the millennials
of
zeitgeist.
And
okay, so John Kelly is Gen X and he's been around for years, but he's starting to get a bit chuggy. Like one thing is his refusal to use the word podcast to describe the fact that you can stream his show after the fact on the website, you know? And
that's just ridiculous.
Yeah. I often wonder why he still turns up to do that show in the evening, because I can't imagine. Like, I sort of think of Lyric as the soundtrack for the old folks' home, you know? Apart from these few hours of light in the evening, John Kelly's show and then The Blue of the Night, but I can't imagine they have huge listenership.
No, I don't know, because, I mean, the advertisers still pay, so obviously some people listen, but you do wonder. And, you know, I've tried and succeeded in getting Blowtorch bands onto these shows, and it is a feeling of validation, and there is a boost to the ego, Hamilton. There's no doubt about it. You know, oh my God, Turnstiles were track of the day or track of the week or whatever it was on Dan Hegarty. It didn't make a huge amount of difference in terms of, I don't know, followers on Spotify or merch sales or number of streams or people visiting the website. Those things were much more affected by live gigs. And that, I think, is partly what Jake was saying, is just this thought that you could put out a guitar track and send it to Paul McLoone and he'd play it and you'd be a success. It is is a fallacy, but it's a dangerous fallacy, because if you follow that route, you're not going to get anywhere. I suppose where he started from was that, you know, all the wailing and gnashing of teeth that a lot of people did when he left Today FM probably wasn't as necessary or as justified. People in that, in the kind of genre that I mainly work in, which is those kind of shouty indie guitar bands, is that there's just less and less places to hear that music. Does it really matter? I don't know. As I say, it's just very validating to hear your tribe being played on the radio.
Yeah.
And that just harks back to me for the days of growing up in the UK in the 70s.
Yeah.
Where all you had was Radio 1, essentially, who just played utter shite all day.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all you could listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got Kid Jensen from 8 o'clock, I think, or maybe Richard Skinner, and then you got Peely at 10, and that's when you felt that you were being catered to, you know, you had a voice.
Yeah.
So I think it's important from that aspect. I think it's important that all genres are represented somewhere in the national consciousness or the national debate. I don't think it's fair that anybody gets left out.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of a musical development, how important it is, I really suspect not much at all. You know, YouTube is the way to go. And the examples that he gave are really good examples. Like Kojak, I think, was number one in the Irish charts this week with his album Town's Dead. You know, Ketamar, Deep Galway DJ, that's another example he used. Like, if you ask somebody in Galway if they'd ever heard of him, they'd say no, never mind somebody in Dublin or the UK or the States. But, I mean, he was down to support the Chemical Brothers last year.
Yeah.
You don't get to support the Chemical Brothers by not having built something, but he built it himself. He didn't rely on anybody in radio to do it for him.
Yeah. That's all I had. Was there anything you wanted to talk about that I didn't cover?
No, I think I've got everything off my chest, Anthony. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat. Yeah, and to be on the other side of the microphone as such for once. I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Not at all.
It's great to talk to like-minded people. It's also great to talk to people outside your comfort zone as well.
Yeah.
And it's good to be challenged. I think that's partly what Jake was getting at as well. It just becomes this cozy chumocracy.
Yeah.
And it just becomes this ever-decreasing circle of credibility.
Well, we won't fix it today, but we try.
Certainly won't. I better go.
Okay, man. Good to talk to you.
And you too. Thanks a million, Anthony.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.